Good evening. This is Life Addle, the Story Show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Addle number 1215, we present three more stories from new Life Addle writer, Leah Jones. Tonight's writer, Leah Jones, was born in 1991, the eldest of three girls. She has lived most of her life near Burford, Ontario, a rural community between Hamilton and London, which, Jones points out, is the proud owner of one traffic light. Jones and her sisters spent their childhood on the farm inherited from their Oma and Opa. Their family grew tomatoes and cucumbers in their greenhouses during the warm months, and spent the winter months operating Christmas and calendar stores across southern Ontario. This combination of small-town values imbued with insight into the consumer industry led Jones to study visual communications and culture, throwing her thoroughly underprepared into the big city life. Leah Jones now lives in Oakville with her elementary school sweetheart and her cat. The stories you will hear tonight and those we presented last Sunday come from Jones' collection, Small Town Girl Versus the Real World. Her compelling writing, simple and sincere, convincingly portrays the coming of age of a young woman who moves from rural Ontario to attend university in the city. Delivered as a series of firsts, first bus trip, first pub night, first house party, first car accident, first traffic jam, and almost a first tattoo. Below the surface, these stories capture more than the expected trepidation and frustration of that crazy life transition. Jones' light touch belies the underlying gravity of tonight's first story. The author's use of precise dialogue and her focus on the small details of each moment leave you with a sinking sensation that isn't easy to shake. Let's listen now as Leah Jones reads her story, Small White Button, tonight on Life Rattle.
Small White Button by Leah Jones. I sit at a bend near the top of the carpeted staircase. Mark sits beside me, and we watch Scott fall laughing into another group of drunken college students as they pile through the door of the boys' house. Mark and Scott rented a townhouse for their first year at Sheridan College, along with two other students, Eric and Krista. They decided to throw a small St. Patrick's Day party with some of their friends from school. When I got there, 24 people filled a small house. Scott drains a six-pack of Alexander Keith's. 1 hour later, the 24 people turns into 40, and the only a few more beers Scott planned on drinking turns into a 12-pack. The overturned recycling bins and half-eaten pots of craft dinner that normally litter the house disappear under the swarm of college students who occupy every crevice of the main hallway, kitchen, and unfinished basement. The smell of overturned beer bottles and sweat-covered bodies struggle to escape through the narrow house's open windows and doors. Muddy shoes slide across the floor, leaving layers of gray-brown sludge that streak the kitchen linoleum. "Who are they?" I ask Mark, and point to a group of guys barreling through the front door with cases of Bud raised above their heads. "I don't know. Not my friends." Mark swirls his beer around in its bottle. Scott holds his arms out, a Keith's in each fist, and welcomes the newcomers. I slide my butt down the step and creep down the stairs. I grab Scott's wrist. "Hey, who are these guys?" He yanks his hand away and finishes the beer clenched in his fist. "This here is Ryan, and Travis, or Taylor, or whatever, and a bunch of other dudes." "Oh." I stumble as one of the other dudes push past me. "Are they your friends?" "What? No, they're just random. Aw, man, how's it going? Like the party?" Scott lurches past me, tosses his empty bottle in the kitchen sink, and high-fives Daryl and Jay, his buddies from Media Fundamentals. Baby, I pull on the rolled sleeve of Scott's green button-up. Why are all these people here if they don't know anyone? Because they want to party, Scott says simply. He turns away and I grab his wrist. He doesn't turn around. Scott, how many beers is that? I ask. I don't know. Lost count after 14. Leave it. Leave me. Alone about it. Geez. He pushes through two gabbing blondes towards the basement stairs. I slide across the edge of the greasy counter and into Scott's bedroom just off the side of the kitchen. I lock the door. I push through the piles of clothes on the floor and flop on his bare mattress. Captain Morgan stares down at me from my unopened bottle of spiced rum on the bookshelf next to my overnight bag. I drain a bottle of water from the side table and toss it into the overflowing blue bin. My eyes close and the sounds of the party blast through the thin door. Someone shakes the door handle and knocks. I ignore it. I lay there awake for half an hour before turning on the boxy gray television and pulling the new Star Trek movie out of its DVD case. Just as the Enterprise arrives at Vulcan, I hear yelling and a muted thump from the kitchen. The sounds of the party dwindle. I slowly approach the door and peek through a small crack before ripping it open. Scott stands alone in the middle of the hall, face red and tensed. A dent in the drywall matches his clenched fist, knuckles bloody. What happened? I rush towards him and dab at the blood with a Kleenex from my pocket. Why? What the hell are you? Fuck off, Leah. Scott throws my hands away and turns, punching the railing with his injured hand. What happened? What happened? Everyone left, because Krista and her dumbass friends started smoking weed in the basement. She's ruining the whole fucking party. Stupid bitch. Scott yells out and whips a water bottle across the kitchen. I put my hand on his shoulder, and he pushes it off. I don't want to fucking talk about it. You just stand there, looking so fucking sad, and it just pisses me off. Fuck off. He storms through the kitchen into the backyard and sits on the patio across from Jay and Daryl, two college friends. The kitchen blurs and tears collect on my lower lashes. I brush them away, hand shaking. I grab a cloth and a bottle of green dish soap from the stove and twist the kitchen tap on full blast. I pull beer bottles out of the sink's basin and line them up along the countertop. Steam pours over my face and mixes with tears as I scrub, wipe, and rinse. The clean cell of soap mixes with the stench of stale beer and dried food. Scott storms into the kitchen and snatches the cloth out of my hand. What the hell are you doing? I whisper. Dishes. Your landlord's coming over tomorrow, remember? Well, stop. Scott throws the cloth into the sink. I snivel. I need to do something or I'm going to explode. Beer floats off Scott's breath as he sighs and pulls me in for a hug. It's just the guys. They can see it, you cleaning, and they keep saying that you're in your rightful place as a woman or whatever. I don't want them saying that stuff about you, okay? Please stop. Stop. He retracts his arms and strides out the open sliding door. I look around the house for Mark, but only find a sticky note on his bedroom door saying he went to a friend's residence for the night. I take the note down before Scott sees it. When I walk back downstairs, Scott and his friends no longer sit out back. My heart flutters and a lump catches my throat. I text Scott and hear his phone's ringtone sounding from the front yard. I push the air out of my lungs and return to the dishes. 5 minutes later, Scott's yells from the front lawn drift through the door and Daryl walks into the kitchen. Hey, Leah, we're going to take Scott on a walk to help him calm down. I think he'd want you to come with us. Daryl smiles. I shake my head and wring out the cloth. No, he doesn't. He doesn't want to see me right now. He doesn't like me to see him when he's angry like this. But I think it'd be good for him to have you there, to cool off, Daryl insists. Okay, well, be careful and let me know how it goes. I slide another plate into the clean pile and grab another ketchup-stained bowl. Confused, Daryl leaves through the front door. He comes back less than 2 minutes later. Really, Leah, I think you should take him on a walk. He's your boyfriend. Daryl's eyes plead. I sigh, smack the faucet's handle, and dry my hands on my jeans. We walk around the block through the brisk March air. Scott's tensed face softens, and his fists loosen. I shiver in my jeans and tank top. Daryl and Jay laugh about some girl at the party. I grab Scott's arm and pull him off the road, out of the path of a speeding cab. He snatches it away and glares at me. A small white button comes off in my hand. Scott, be careful, okay? Please? I want you home safe. I try to hold his hand. He grabs my upper arm and pulls me ahead of the others. He turns to me, blue eyes burning through me. I am so sick of this. You never have fun anywhere, and I'm tired of trying to make it fun for you. My temper flares and I try to respond, but Scott interrupts. I am sick of you and your stupid, depressed look. I don't want you here. Fucking no one does. Go home. Scott turns back to Daryl and fakes a laugh and a smile. The two boys glare at me. The street shakes and my head boils. I turn and yell something at Scott, but can't understand what angry words fall out of my mouth. I turn on my heel and storm back into the house, throwing the small white button as hard as I can at the pavement. I wake up with Scott's arm over my waist. An icy breeze drifts through the open window across the room. I shut it and lay back on the bed, on my side, at the edge of the mattress. Scott mumbles and turns to face me. He smells like beer and sweat. His eyes open. I stare at my fingertips, cracked from the dish soap. Morning, baby. Scott smiles and sits up, cracking his back and neck. Did you sleep good? It feels kind of cold in here for you. I spin the ring he gave me 2 Christmases ago around my finger and stare at nothing. Scott pokes my arm and his smile grows. You're all goose bumpy. He looks over at the pile of empty beer cases. Man, it must have been a good party last night. What time did I go to bed? I shrug and sit up to face the wall. Scott gets up and pulls on his favorite blue t-shirt. I have no idea, honestly. It was like you got here, and then there were lots of people. Something about a pineapple. Scott laughs to himself. Then, wall. Nothing. He grabs a water bottle out of the case by the window and downs half of it. Angry brown scabs speckle his knuckles. My fingers tremble. Scott falls back onto the bed behind me and twists his arms around my stomach. What about you, baby? I know you don't like this kind of stuff. Plus, knowing me, I probably didn't spend as much time with you as I should have. But did you at least have a good time? My chest heaves and I sob into my hands. Scott's smile drops.
That was Leah Jones reading her story, Small White Button. Tonight's second story centers on our narrator's struggle to make a decision amid a circle of contrary influences. Let's listen now as Leah Jones reads her story, Medieval Dragons and Crayon Cats.
Medieval Dragons and Crayon Cats by Leah Jones. A short, gangly young man sits at a white front desk in a tattoo parlor. His hand holds a ballpoint pen, swirling over transparent paper, creating a stylized, symmetrical chandelier. A pink-haired, tattooed woman sits next to him and talks on a red cordless phone. Tchaikovsky drifts down from the speakers, nestled next to a glass door that seals out the bitter February cold. I sit on a soft, white cot in the next room, tapping my fingers on my knees and staring at the snow building up in the side window of the Good Point Tattoo and Piercing shop. This was a bad idea. I'm not going to go through with this. No way. I think it would look hot, says Scott. He runs down the diving board of my parents' pool and jumps, curving his body into a swan dive. I hold my breath as his head just misses the edge of the board by 2 inches. He surfaces. I sigh. Scott pulls himself up to sit next to me on the concrete hot from the July sun. I churn my feet in the warm, chlorinated water. It would hurt. A lot, I tell him. Oh, it wouldn't be that bad. It doesn't take that long. Scott pokes me in the ribs. You just have a horrible pain tolerance. He kisses my cheek and slides back into the pool. I rub my side. I glance at the parlor's clock. The woman assigned to my appointment left to answer the phone less than a minute ago. Anxiety bubbles in my throat. I swallow and look around the room. A set of rolling drawers sits next to me. Inside lie thick metal bars, thin curved needles, and what looks like a sharp metal pen attached to a thick handle. Decorative square and hexagonal mirrors with golden frames hang around the white room. A rough sketch of a medieval dragon hangs next to an oil painting of an English bulldog. A framed photograph of a woman's hands covered in bright primary tribal tattoos hovers over a faded print of a French movie poster. A crayon drawing of an orange tabby is taped next to a framed, vivid Native American design. The cat stares at me. A sink surrounded with boxes of gloves and disinfectants is fastened to a wall behind the door. Above the sink hangs a signed skateboard deck painted in bold purples and acidic greens to make it look like street graffiti. I can't make out the signature. Curtains hang over tall black shelving units, their purple hem brushing the shining linoleum floor. The shop reminds me of a dentist's office, a pimped-out dentist's office. I can hear the pink-haired woman chatting in the next room. How pissed would she be if I just left? Jordan, how many tattoos do you have? I ask, turning to my friend and coworker. I pull another flower stem out of the warm dirt in Slayman greenhouses where I work on summer break. My lifelong friend Sophie sits the next aisle over. Just the two, hip and neck, Jordan says. I want another one, though. I wipe sweat off my face with the back of my roughed, gloved hand. Jordan slides her daisies into a clear sleeve. Would you ever get one? A tattoo? I don't know. I've thought about it. That's a big decision, though, I say. I was thinking maybe another piercing instead. Jordan rolled her eyes. What? Your belly button or something? Piercings are a pain in the ass for soccer. She pulls more elastics around her ring finger. Get a tattoo. My guy's awesome. I don't know what I'd get, though. Plus, I'm pretty sure my mom would kill me. I fiddle with my clipper's rusty lock. Doesn't your mom have one? Sophie calls over. On her lower back, right? Well, yeah, I reply. But she got that when she was 40, not 19. Leah, this is the mom who routinely bought us coolers when we were 16. Sophie throws a dozen bunches of purple flat on her shoulder. You were the one who refused to drink them. She wouldn't care if you got a tattoo. She'd make fun of you for like 5 minutes and then tell you how good it looks. Jordan laughs. My phone buzzes next to me on the cot. I hold the scratched unlock button with my chipped thumbnail, and a text pops up. Scott wants to know what time I'm done from class. He doesn't know I'm here. I shouldn't have listed my mom as the emergency contact on that form the woman gave me. I drop my phone into my purse on the floor and bring my right thumb into my mouth. There isn't enough nail to bite down on. I hear the woman hang up the phone and fiddle with the stack of papers. Oh God. I let the heavy door of my apartment slam shut and throw my backpack and winter jacket on the wood-paneled floor. I find a purple sticky note from Scott on the banister, reminding me he'd be home from the gym just before dinner. I flop on the forest green faux leather couch, throw my feet onto the coffee table, and pull my MacBook onto my lap. I stare at my overscheduled iCal and add test on immigration to the blue square designating next Monday. I hate February. I quit the calendar program and log onto Facebook. Sophie posted more pictures from her adventures at the bar. Mom changed her profile picture to a photo of her bright yellow motorcycle. Jordan added a photo of her new tattoo, a jeweled bird perched on her ribs. The surrounding skin glows a raw, irritated pink. My eyes rest on Good Point Tattoo and Piercing's homepage, hiding in the second browser tab. I grab my jacket, purse, and keys off the floor and take the stairs to the building's parking garage. The woman enters the parlor's back room. Her bullring nose, two lip, and three eyebrow piercings sparkle in the fluorescent lights. Including the studs in her ears, I count 8 total. I swallow my nerves. Okay, sorry about that. Let's get this started. She pulls blue vinyl gloves over her tattooed hands. I spin my ring around my finger. So I know I told you the process before I had to leave. Do you remember, or do you want me to go over it again? I don't remember, I think. I remember, I lie. You can just do it. I slowly lay myself down on the cot, gripping the freshly laid towel beneath me. My eyes settle on the crayon cat. It stares back. Just relax. It will only hurt for a second. She turns around and opens a clear drawer. I close my eyes. I hear a metallic clinking sound as she finds what she needs. I take a deep breath and spin my ring around my finger. She puts her hand on my forehead and stabs a piercing needle into my nose.
That was Leah Jones reading her story, Medieval Dragons and Crayon Cats. Tonight's final story takes us on a very, very slow journey away from the city in the company of our frustrated narrator, full of sarcastic wit and sharp observations, and her disgruntled cat. Let's listen now as Leah Jones reads her story, Friday Traffic Jam.
Friday Traffic Jam by Leah Jones. Hundreds of cars, SUVs, and trucks clog the westbound 403. Service roads lined with office buildings, discount depots, and car dealerships run along both sides of the highway. For the first time since moving to Oakville, my Honda Pilot and I joined commuters in the Friday 5 p.m. drudge out of the GTA. Commercials from the AM news station crackle over the radio. I tip my head to the left and feel the satisfying pop from the joints in my neck. Oliver screams in the back seat. I groan. Buddy, I know. I'm sorry, okay? Oliver lets out a grating meow. He pulls at the plastic cage's barred door with his claws, rattling the lock in its catch. Oliver only likes his cage on solid ground. The gold Prius in front of me slides forward a few feet. I follow. The speedometer's orange needle twitches behind the dust-covered plastic dash. I push my shoulders back and peer over the line of cars, searching for emergency or construction lights. Oliver screeches. I stare longingly as a blue sedan cruises along the carpool lane to my left. When coming off the ramp at Trafalgar an hour ago, I almost merged into the high occupancy lane out of habit before I realized Scott wasn't in the front seat. I doubt an adolescent cat counts as a second passenger. We creep forward another few feet. I received an email the past Tuesday from Slayman Greenhouses, my summer employer back home. Brian asked me to come in Saturday morning to help the full-timers catch up. I wanted to go home to Burford. I wanted the money. I said yes, despite the get-together my UTM girlfriends planned for Friday night. I like Burford. I miss Burford. The closest thing Burford gets to a traffic jam is four cars stuck behind a combine on a gravel road. How did I forget about rush hour, Ollie? I ignore his response and take a swig from my water bottle. My cell phone buzzes in my purse. Mom made me promise not to text while driving. I look at the speedometer. 0 kilometers an hour. I'm not driving. I'm parked. I slide out the phone's QWERTY keyboard and unlock the screen. A text from Scott pops up. Bus just got into Peterborough. Waiting for the guys. Love you. Give Ollie a kiss for me. I snort and stick my tongue out at Oliver instead. He yawns and rattles his door. I send Scott a heart and bite my lip. I wish he chose to come home with me instead. We inch under the looming sign for Burloak, its shadow sliding over the hood of my truck. Oliver lets out an ear-wrenching meow. Oliver, please, just, okay? I pull my hair up off my neck, twirl it into a bun, and slide down in my seat. A commercial for sofas cheerily spews out the store's phone number, and a newswoman speaks the carefully worded line. And next up is traffic. I turn up the volume and grunt, hooray, traffic. Everyone loves traffic. Thanks, Joanne. The traffic guy sounds like he belongs in that crappy sofa commercial. Nothing crazy today. Just some minor delays on the 407 due to an earlier accident. The 403 is a little slow westbound between Mississauga Road and Brant Street. Nothing too bad there. What? I yell, startling Ollie mid-meow. Nothing too... a little slow. What the fuck is wrong with this place? I look back at Oliver. Seriously, it's taken over an hour to go 4 exits. 4 freaking exits. He looks back up at me, amber eyes wide. I imagine his little head bob to mean he agrees with me. Traffic McCheery face doesn't mention any accidents and moves on to the Don Valley Parkway. I flip the radio to FM and to the only Toronto station I know. Rush, Scott's favorite band that month, blares out the speakers. I curse Geddy Lee's jarring voice and smack the volume knob, turning the sound system off completely. Stupid Rush, stupid Scott, stupid work. Only 3 more exits before the highway splits to Niagara and Hamilton. Dad told me the traffic would get better when most vehicles take the Niagara route. What even causes this? Why are there so many cars? My voice slips into whininess, and I smack the back of my head against the headrest, the impact ramming my bun into my skull. I sigh and pull down my hair, slipping the blue elastic back over my right wrist. 2 more exits. I should have stayed with the girls. This is not a traffic jam. A traffic jam is where there's an accident, or construction, or a funeral procession. This is bullshit. I slide my fingers through the bars of Oliver's cage in attempt to get him to shut up. He squeaks out a meow. I sigh. If we're going this slow, someone better have died. I grab my water bottle for another sip, but it only holds half a mouthful. I drop the bottle into the passenger seat. One more exit. Oliver meows. Oliver, would you please just shut your face? I can see the sign warning drivers of the split. I squeeze into the center lane. Come on. Come on. Almost there. I curve right off the split, speed up to 60 kilometers an hour beneath the 407 overpass, and slam on the brakes to avoid hitting the dead-still transport waiting for me around the bend. The stop throws Oliver into the door of his cage. I look around the truck. Still traffic saturates the highway. You have got to be... I give up. I let Oliver out of his cage and sit him on the front seat. My paycheck had better be worth this shit.
That was Leah Jones reading her story, Friday Traffic Jam. That concludes Life Rattle number 1215. My name is Lori Callis. I recorded Leah reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday night at 9 to hear more new stories.